Hello, and welcome to Big Mouth, home of finely milled handmade pop culture nitpicking. I'm Andrew Harrison, and with me as usual is Sean Pattenden, the dependable Michaela Strachan to my Pete Waterman. Hello, Sean. How are you?
I'm all right, thank you.
How's your week been?
It's been full of me making my own breakfasts.
Making your own breakfast?
Yes,
well,
in a weird way, yeah.
It's good for personal discipline. We have two exciting guests with us this week. Making his Big Mouth debut is Peter Robinson, creator of Pop Justice, which started out as a blog and has evolved into the destination for grown-up pop with a capital P music. Peter got into music journalism by making a KLF fanzine, which makes me feel both ancient and not very justified. He wrote the Peter Robinson Versus column for The Enemy for a decade, and he carries on the smash hits, quotes, tradition, quote, of doing foolish things with the English language in order to make pop stars seem more interesting. Hello, Peter. Welcome to Big Mouth. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Glad to finally be here.
You went to that KLF reunion thing in Liverpool, didn't you? How yes. was that?
It was... I think if you hadn't been into the KLF, you would look at it and say, well, this is just awful and bad. On the way up, I was thinking, have I spent £100 plus, taken 3 days off work during the week and spent money on accommodation? Is this good use of my money?
Yeah.
And up until the point when Jarvis Cocker appeared with loads of people in robes singing Justified and Ancient with two coffins being carried around and everyone going mental and me crying, oh. I thought it wasn't worth the money. But at that split second, it was like, this is great. Then we went on a 3 mile walk through Liverpool. Mm. And there was a bonfire and a rave up.
Fantastic.
It was good. And somebody, my review.
Somebody graffitied the bombed out church, didn't they? Which went down very badly with local conservation.
Yeah, one of the days was spent because it was, they said it wasn't. It was a glorified book launch. Actually, they ended up also launching a funeral company at the end of it as well.
Yeah.
But there was a part in the bomb, we spent a day in the bombed out church. Everyone was given a page from the book and we had to sort of come together as chapters and create a thing each. Mm. From the chapters. Some of it was very good, some of it not so much.
Did you create a bit?
We created a poster, which was a postmodern comment on something or other. but somebody got a bit carried away with the KLF tradition of graffitiing things and started daubing white paint on the inside of this obviously listed property of great significance and got told off. But then the KLF, Bill and Jimmy, one of the guys who came up, one of the 400 attendees, had a replica of Ford Time Lord, the famous Doctor in the TARDIS car, which is an amazing, like spot-on replica. And while we were all in the bombed-out church, Bill and Jimmy went out with white emulsion and painted the entire thing white, which the guy was not happy. He just sped off to the nearest car wash.
You'd be very conflicted, wouldn't you?
I mean, they'd created some art.
Yeah.
But
they'd also ruined some art.
Yeah.
What's happening with Pop Justice? Because you have actually become, almost by mistake, the most powerful thing in pop, haven't you?
That is a nice thing to say. may well have been more accurate in 2006. But it's still going. Mm-hmm. There have not been any major legal proceedings against Pop Justice and the server hasn't crashed. So I think I'd chalk that up as a success.
That's pretty good going, yeah. And also, I wanted to ask you, in the Smash Hits tradition, what's the most unfortunate question you asked when you were doing Peter Robinson Versus in the NME? Which question went down the most badly?
I wonder which one it was. I'm not sure. But something happened during my chat with Carlos Santana where... he objected so strongly that at the end of the phone interview, he thought that we'd been disconnected and that he was just talking to his publicist, but I was still on the line. He asked her in no uncertain terms not to put him in any interview situations like that. And then I said, what's the problem, Carlos? So maybe that... then we had an argument which ended up being printed. Great days, right?
Oh, those the days.
So maybe what's the problem, Carlos, is the unfortunate question.
You can call your book that.
Also joining us this week is Dan Mayer, TV and radio comedy writer who has done the gags for everything from Harry Hill's TV Burp and TV Dinner, Anton Deck's Saturday Night Takeaway, Johnny Vaughan, Frank Skinner and Alistair McGowan. That's loads. He also co-wrote the Sky Detective spoof A Touch of Cloth with Charlie Brooker. But what is most important is that he loves his 60s freak beat, psych and everything that sounds like the Fall. Hello, Dan. Welcome to Big Mouth.
Hello. What a lovely introduction.
How are you?
I'm very well, thanks.
Good. Have you got over the death of Marky Smith yet?
No.
Are you ever going to get over the death of Marky Smith?
That's a long shadow. That's going to take, I don't know, when I've sort of... It's getting to that time that they should be touring again. So I'm going to start missing it. That's the thing, isn't it? You can start missing the gigs. That's going to take 2 or 3 years until I finally realise somewhere deep down inside that there aren't going to be any more Fall gigs.
Yeah. We spotted that you spotted that actually the final lineup of the fall would be playing with Damo Suzuki.
Yeah.
In months to come. This is quite amazing. This is a bit like the Cramps getting together with Gene Vincent as the front man or something. It's like the originator.
And apparently you're going to be talking about Victorian genius nutbag Francis Galton at Conway Hall on June the 11th.
Well, this is a thing, a talk that I did a few years ago. I just sort of chanced upon this chap, Francis Galton, who is a genius, eccentric polymath. I started doing this talk about him. Mm-hmm. I'm doing it again at the Curious Festival in June or July. I thought I should do, because I haven't done it for so long, I thought I should do a warm-up gig.
Yes.
So Conway Hall is where I've previously done the talk a few times, so I'm doing it there to remind myself how it goes. But it's, he's sort of amazing. He's known as the father of eugenics.
Okay.
He coined
the
term eugenics. But the talk isn't about that. The talk is about all the other stuff that
he did,
people have kind of forgotten
again.
About.
Yeah.
This is the thing. He's sort of, people think that he's reduced to being the sort of grandfather of the Nazis.
Yeah.
Whereas, in fact, he also discovered anticyclones and invented the dog whistle, which is the and
so
lots of other stuff.
This is your dog whistle about dog whistles. I know, right, great, okay.
And lots of other stuff. So the whole talk is basically about all the other weird, funny, mad stuff that he did.
Andrew, what have we got on this show today?
We have got The City and the City, BBC Two's eye-bending adaptation of China Mieville's mind-bending Kafkaesque cop novel, starring David Morrissey. Does it work? And moreover, can you tell what's going on? Also, Confidence Man. They are the Australian D-Lite and their debut album is out this week. Spoiler, I love it, but what do the panel think? Also, original R&B lady band En Vogue, sort of Destiny's grandma, reunite for the album Electric Cafe. Will it free our minds and will our asses follow? And Dan, Peter, Sean and I each choose the greatest 10 seconds in pop music in history. All this and more after this brief message.
If you're a regular listener, you'll know that we're asking for a little help to cover our studio and recording expenses. And if you're not, well, we're asking for a little help to cover our studio and recording expenses. If you buy us an imaginary, virtual, non-physical pint once a month via the crowdfunding platform Patreon, it'll help us pay our bills and keep the show going. A mere fiver a month from 120 listeners will cover all our studio costs. Our target is £600 a month and we are well on the way. Once we reach our target, we'll start doing extra bits each week just for our lovely Patreon backers. Go to patreon.com/bigmouthpodcast to find out more. Or you can find the link at the top of the Big Mouth Facebook page. All we're saying is, buy us
a
pint.
OK, let's get started with The City and the City, the surrealist detective story by China Mieville. Fantasy novelist of the new weird, has been described as entirely unfilmable. So hats off to BBC Two for even trying. The story of Inspector Theodore Borloo, of the extreme crime squad in the fictional city of Bechel, and his attempts to solve a murder that defies not just logic but also geography, is on BBC Two on Friday nights. David Morrissey plays Borloo. A lot of fags are smoked and few laughs are had in a world that resembles Eastern Europe at its most dismal. What did we think? We're going to talk about it after this taster.
Nowhere else works like the cities. Bechel and Olcoma.
Girl from Olcoma winds up dead in Bechel.
Mahalia is dead because she found out the truth.
I knew there was another city I dare not see. Just on the other side of where I was permitted to look.
There's a price for speaking the truth.
Solve Mahalia, you solve your wife.
This is our city, and we want it back!
They're scared.
So am I.
The City and the City on BBC Two.
Girlfriend in Olcoma, I know it's serious. David Morrissey in China Mieville's The City in the City. This is the most unfilmable book because it's all about a state of mind. Peter Robinson, firstly, before, did you enjoy it? Did you understand it?
Yes.
Good.
Same can't quite be said for my wife because we watched it together and I knew what it was about, but she didn't. And she, bless her, did her thing of talking over the first minute or so, which was the big exposition bit where I actually explained what was happening. So it was about half an hour before she said, I don't understand this.
That's pretty good.
Having obviously missed the bit where it explains what is actually happening. So that's quite good, I think, to be able to not actually understand or have any idea of concept of the fact that there is something strange about this situation and to still have been enjoying it.
And what exactly is happening?
Okay, right. What's happening is, you know how on Twitter you follow a load of people who you like,
yeah,
right? But there's also another Twitter happening.
Parallel Twitter.
Oh.
At the same time, right? Full of idiots and white supremacists.
Mm-hmm.
Not that the two are by any means mutually exclusive. Well, it's like that in a city where two things are happening at the same time, and you sort of know systems. One is happening out the corner of your feed, you're not allowed to look at it. You are brought up not looking at it, and it's like that in a sort of geographical way. So there's a city sort of on top of a city, or sideways to a city, or underneath, or in the same space as a city, but it's not actually there.
They're superimposed, aren't they? And they occupy the same geographical space, but the citizens of one city culturally just they call it unseeing, don't they? They unsee what they're not supposed to see. And seeing stuff that's in the other city is a major social, political crime. And you can be vanished. You can be Kafka'd away down a hole and never seen again.
The breach deal with you.
The breach come and get you. Yes.
The breach are the kind of starsy, aren't they?
Yeah. Well, the breach is...
The geography is slightly confusing because the idea seems to be that these things, they overlap and they're superimposed, but at the same time, there are physical border crossings.
Yeah.
So they seem to be side by side and on top of each other at the same time. The geography is quite difficult to unpick, I think.
Yeah. Did anybody read the book, by the way?
No.
I've read the book. The book is brilliant and very enjoyable because for exactly the reason that for the first sort of 60 pages, you have no idea what's going on. But when it finally clicks that you are kind of in this superimposed world, because it's not presented to you visually, you're inside the characters' heads and they're fully acculturated to this. You slowly become acculturated and you have this amazing sense of discovery and the floor drops away. And it's literalised on television, isn't it? Because we see Bejel, which is where Borlu comes from, is this kind of tatty Eastern European, Middle European thing with like sad, weak yellow light. And then out the corner of your eye, you can see the beautiful gleaming blue and neon red world of Olcoma that's out of focus, but you're not supposed to see it. And he keeps turning away from it. It literalises it, which makes it more immediate, but also kind of takes away that thrill of discovery, really.
Yeah.
Did you enjoy it, Dan? Did you enjoy the show?
I did quite enjoy it. I was got my head around it. I mean, I think the exposition is actually gradual. There is obviously a bit of explanation, as Peter says, at the beginning, but there are also moments where they spoon-feed you a little bit. I mean, there is layered on top of this, a fairly routine police procedural. And as part of that, there's a girl who's been murdered and her parents, her
not
American
to see that
parents.
For a change, right?
Yeah, great to see that. You don't get the blue boob shot, though, which is what, when we were doing Touch of Cloth, I was talking about the blue boob shot, the very gratuitous.
The written the detective spoof, which is what
the come on, we need the blue boobs.
Yeah.
But what I was going to say is the parents of this murdered girl come in and this system is sort of explained to them in the back of a taxi because they're sort of outsiders and they sort of. So that's a kind of useful device for explaining a bit more to the viewer about
it's
what the
Mr.
hell's
and Mrs. Basil
on.
Exposition arriving.
It was Mr.
Basil on a tourist visa, and they and their mistakes also expose a huge part about the way this all works.
Mr. and Mrs. Basil Exposition.
Mrs. Basil Expedition. Write that down.
One of the things that's interesting about it actually is when you get these obviously sort of classic journey of the hero descending into the underworld and all this sort of stuff. Here, they only seem to start off in the underworld.
Yeah.
I think normally, if you had this set up for a story, you'd assume that the place where we start, where we're rooted, would be the shiny place, and you would journey into the weird, dysfunctional, dark, grimy place. And it's quite interesting that actually it's sort of done the other way around.
It's quite Chinamavi to have an underworld, and then under that underworld, another underworld. But it's just underworlds all the way down to the bottom with Chinamavi. It gets more... And there is the sort of...
Underworld.
Underest world. There's the implication. There's actually a third city called Orsini.
Which
will play out later in this kind of thing. Sean, did you enjoy it?
I really enjoyed it. I liked the concept more than I probably enjoyed the programme. And you're waiting for the next exposition. You're waiting for the next character to phone up and say, actually, this is happening. Oh, another bit of plot. Oh, we actually know what's going on. But it's very basic. You say it's a detective story. And the dialogue is very hard-boiled cop. It's really basic. It's short sentences. It's David Morrissey. I don't really get the David Morrissey in it. He is the voice of banking and sensibleness, and he's the sensible man who drinks and smokes a lot. I don't know if he's got enough edge for me to actually really enjoy.
His performance is quite camp in a way. Like there's the bit at the start where he's does his opening monologue and it ends with, I'm a cop.
Yes. Hard-boiled lingo that's coming
they
into
kind
the dialogue.
Of get away with it because of all
satire
because of all the stuff that's going on underneath. It's like they can sort of get away with some of those tropes. The sidekick, the sweary potty mouth sidekick. The flashbacks to what happened to my wife, which is totally, completely did in Touch of Cloth. But you can sort of, they think they can get away with those tropes because the whole environment is so weird.
But I actually like that. It's like take, because he doesn't try. Apparently, Mirville wrote this for his mother, who was dying and was a major fan of police procedurals. So he wrote his version of police. I wonder what Ma Mirville thought when she got this kind of Franz Kafka writing. it must have been... I think it works fantastically, the fact that those straightforward conventions, because they are totally... You know, if you take away the world of the two cities, it is the most conventional cop thing going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes.
And he uses that as a way into this bizarre world. I thought it was fantastic.
Well, that's sometimes the test, isn't it? If you take away whatever the high concept part of it is, yeah. is what's left still a good story? And from episode one, I'm not sure if.
Yeah. See, I don't know whether I want justice to be done. I don't know whether I want him to find out what happens. But I actually might watch it, as I say, because the concept, I'm quite interested on how many worlds we can get.
I don't think it's too much of a spoiler to say that the story veers away from murder into what are these places and why do they work the way that they work?
Yeah. I watched the second. I was interested enough to watch the second ep. And you can tell by the end of that it's turning into something slightly more science fiction-y. Kind of search for Atlantis.
Well, it's unique in this world in that there is no magic. There's no kind of special magic-y science going on here. It's everything that's happening could happen. It's all of the strangeness is within people's heads and within their conventions. Yeah. No wizard turns up and says, aha, created a magic city.
Yes, but there are hieroglyphs. There are symbols. There is a magic there. And it's a very hunky professor, can I just say?
Oh, yeah.
So I might keep watching just to see how his character develops, maybe.
So, I mean, tentatively we're giving this thumbs up. I really liked it. I thought it was a very successful adaptation of a book that I knew. You guys don't know it, and
I will watch the rest. There's a whiff, maybe partly down to Mandeep Dillon's accent, there's a whiff of Radio 4 mid-afternoon drama about it, especially with the voiceovers. But I like the look of it, and I'm interested in the next twists and turns.
The voiceovers do make it a little bit Murder in Successville as well. Some of his... there was something I had to do first.
Do you think they might have Blade Runnered it in that, like, they delivered a cut and the commissioning editor's gone, I haven't got a bleeding clue what's going on here.
The accents thing is interesting as well, because when you do have that problem, if you create an imaginary city and you're not trying to locate to any one place, what do you do about accents? They've kind of got the Death of Stalin issue there. And obviously they embraced it in Death of Stalin. I'm not sure it quite works here that you have a sort of Cockney sidekick. You've got a Liverpool lead. There's a couple of Yorkshires and Manx.
Brash. Yeah, that kind of thing.
It could have maybe done with some actual, Eastern European actors.
But I kind of buy the Death of Stalin argument. At the minute people start putting on funny voices, you're thinking about, is the funny voice any good, rather than listening to the dialogue. But anyway, The City in the City, available now on iPlayer.
Yeah. Let's get back to the real world, whatever that is. We always ask our guests to bring in a tune for the listeners. Peter Robinson, what have you brought in for us today?
I've brought in a new song by a female artist from Brisbane. Now, she's 25. Now, all I'm saying is, about 30 years ago, two young lovers called Scott and Charlene headed to Brisbane to start a family. Now, I'm not saying that Hatchie is their love child, but there's a possibility there. This is kind of like a pop version of shoegaze, I guess.
Okay.
Pop gaze,
which
is difficult.
Pop
this is not
is great,
ideal
yeah.
for radio, but maybe in print it works a bit better. But I was going to ask Andrew, actually, because as a man who's coined a few terms for different genres, maybe he, after we've listened to it, will have a better idea of what to call this.
Well, because I did my research, because I'm a professional and I listened to it. And I'm all over pop gazing. Let's invent pop gazing.
Oh, yeah.
Here's the sound of pop gaze with Sugar and Spice by Hatchie. But you don't call me baby. Stop looking at your shoes. That was Sugar and Spice by Hatchie, as chosen by Peter Robinson. Okay, more pop music, more Australian pop music. Confidence Man are quite the thing of the moment. An Australian four-piece with a statuesque front woman called Janet Planet and a bloke in hot pants fronting two mysterious characters that we don't know much about who wear hoods and things like that. The music is effervescent pop with a snarky edge, and their debut album, Confident Music for Confident People, is out now. We're going to talk about it after this track, Don't You Know I'm in a Band.
Don't you know I'm in a band?
Smiling 'cause the drugs are free. And the girls all... Don't You Know I'm in a Band by Confidence Man from the album Confident Music for Confident People. This is proper grown-up adult pop. Peter Robinson, you may have an opinion on it. What did you think about Confidence Man?
I enjoyed it very much once. I think I'd like to see them live once, probably. They remind me a bit of somewhere, maybe cross between sort of Go Team, Alpha Beat and the Scissor Sisters.
Yeah. And yeah. The problem with that is what?
Right. The problem, right, is Scissor Sisters. I remember that Glastonbury when, which was actually discussed a couple of weeks ago on this very show, wasn't it? The Glastonbury when they played two shows in one day. They basically won Glastonbury despite not.
They did
being
a world tour of Glastonbury.
They did, yeah. And it was they hadn't had that much out, and the general vibe was, oh, they've had this hit, but actually they've got real songs as well. You know, there's great songwriting in there. They're a real band, and I wonder, beyond the sort of quirk and the general sort of soundscape that they've created and the fun that they are and the energy they've got, I wonder where the big songs are. Mm. Where's the big songwriting is my question.
Ooh. Dan, what did you think?
I think you've got to have a heart of granite not to find this album fun.
Yes. And as a man with a heart of granite...
And as a man with a heart of granite, I hated it. I despised every twinkly, glittery smile. No, I did enjoy it. I think it's in the best possible way, I don't mean this in a pejorative way, it's background listening. It's a party album. For me, it's something you'd stick on at a party and it would be a mood lifter, but it doesn't necessarily reward intense listening. I think there's not much variation within the album. It's kind of, there's an idea and that idea runs through it. And that idea is that sort of cool, uncool, silly pop, which is fine and I think works really well. I don't know if I would sit and listen intensely to it, but I don't think that's its purpose. I think it's kind of a fun mood lifter.
I found myself listening to it in four times in succession yesterday, which makes me think possibly I need my mood lifting, because it really did. And I was completely... Sean, what did you think?
I got the album on Sunday afternoon, which was rainy and miserable and disgusting out there. And I put it on and I thought, they got my memo. They got it. It managed to get all the way to Australia. I love this album.
Yeah.
Like you, Andrew, I actually can't stop listening to it in quite a weird, obsessive way. It's so cheery, but it's got all that Screamadelica. It's got Sly Stone. It's got D-Light. It's got all that underneath it. I think there's a soul to it. And I think it's really, really hard to do music that is joyous, exciting and happy and let's all go down the rave up, and not for it to be a novelty, not for it to slide into a slight sort of cheeky girl sort of situation, which you could with a front woman who is quite, you know, I mean, there's a lot of jokes in there and there's a lot of saucy.
They are very
sort
funny
of,
as well.
I just loved it, though.
There's some very funny lines. I wish I had a boy my folks could meet. Yes. I wish I had a room with an ensuite. You know, just what I like about them is that they're sort of doing that sort of, you know, they're doing the annoying hipster thing while making mock of it at the same time.
Yeah, I think there's a cool uncool. It's like layers of an onion. It's so uncool, it's cool, but then it sort of becomes uncool again.
They've described it themselves as cool in a bad way.
Right.
I'd rather have that than bad
when
and cool.
When you're saying things like, I'm a cool party girl in a cool party world, that is, it's impossible to do that and be cool. Yeah. And they're sort of doing that really to sink the ship, aren't they?
And on
they?
That traction, they then describe a party which is so ridiculously over-the-top, self-referential, cool that it's funny. And she goes, I've been to big parties, I've been to cool parties, I've been to gay parties. I went to a party where a guy stuck a light bulb up his ass. I love the raviness of this, because there's loads of things that I'd missed for ages, like Funky Drummer actually turns up on Better Sit Down Boy, and Catch My Breath basically turns into I Feel Love, Cool Party basically is Groovers in the Heart, isn't it?
I just wanted to go out and dance to it when I heard it.
I'm 51, is it weird for me to like music like this? This is aimed at like 22-year-old groovers, in novelty glasses, isn't
it? Is it though? Well, is it aimed at people 35 plus?
You see, I think I agree with Peter. It's actually aimed for all of us who remember 1991 and going down the front.
Well, I don't care, because this is my album of the year so far, tying with Us Girls. I think it's fantastic.
I agree with you. I just think it's amazing. I think you should all put it on repeat, both of you, and everybody else listening should just put it on repeat until it comes in your DNA. We can all go out dancing.
Well, I did see them saying that they make music to please people at 2 a.m. on the dance floor, and I think if in the unlikely event of me at this stage of my life being at 2 a.m. on the dance floor anytime soon... That will hit the spot perfectly.
Okay. Well, that's Confidence Man with Confident Music for Confident People, and it's available where you get music these days.
Let's have a bit more music, why don't we? Dan Mayer, what track would you like to play and why?
Yeah, well, I'm getting really cutting edge and modern and latest releases. I brought a Bangles record.
Not wrong with that.
Only about 35 years old. This I hadn't thought about the Bangles for a while, but then I was looking at a playlist which a friend of this parish, Jude Rogers, put together for a 40th birthday, and there were some Bangles on there. And it started me thinking about the Bangles and thinking how many great singles they'd had and how I hadn't really thought of them beyond that as a singles band. And I started listening to one of their albums, to Different Light, which I think was their second album. And I was struck, that's like a weird thing to say, I was struck by how 80s it sounded. Because I think at the time,
like
they were sort of, because they were sort of fetishized the 60s, I suppose, with Jangle and Rickenbackers and things, you sort of didn't notice in the 80s how 80s they actually were.
Yeah.
And I always found that quite interesting, looking back now at bands of previous eras doing earlier eras. And I wonder whether, you know, did Shawadi Wadi genuinely sound like a doo-wop group in the 50s? Is it only with the benefit of hindsight that they sound like a 70s group? And so on and so forth.
The insane thing with something like Shawadi Wadi, it was only really about 15 years previously, the thing that they were spoofing. So that's like us now going, wow, this really sounds like Franz Ferdinand, you know, in 2004, like the dim and distant misty CP black and white past of 2004.
Well, this is stuff like the Strokes at the time, think, well, this is a really, they've sort of nailed that sort of skinny tie new wave thing. I wonder if you listen to the Strokes in 20 years' time, it'll actually sound like that, or whether it'll sound really of its time. And there's something about the production techniques of a time that you don't notice until about 10, 20 years later. But anyway, so I was listening to Bangles, and the 80s-ness wasn't putting me off. But I sort of fell in love with If She Knew What She Wants, which had sort of passed me by slightly at the time, which is a brilliant, brilliant single. And I've been sort of listening to that almost as much as you've been listening to the Confidence Man album.
All right. Well, let's have a listen to it. This is the Bangles, If She Knew What She Wants. Then one day she's satisfied, and the next I find her crying, and it's nothing she can
Bangles, If She Knew What She Wants, as chosen by Dan Mayer. Now, when Andrew saw that En Vogue were back with an album called Electric Cafe, he got very excited at the thought of them doing music non-stop, Sex Object, and a 28-minute version of Boing Boom Shack. Of course, En Vogue covering the least good Kraftwerk album in its entirety would be amazing, but unfortunately that's not what Rona, Terry and Cindy, for it is they, have done. What have they done, and is it any good? We'll find out after the title track from Electric Cafe. By En Vogue, from Electric Cafe by En Vogue, the comeback album of the original woman pop band, now a three-piece. My Lovin' was the woman power pop anthem of 1992. Is there anything similar here we can wave our scarves to, Dan? What did you think about this album? Oh dear, you're not
really
looking
really well.
Happy.
You know, this is another background album, but in a bad way. It's a grown up smooth loving R&B kind of slight, far too slick and sleek, and I couldn't get any purchase on it really. There's no grit there for
There's no standout track for you, Electric
Not
Cafe.
Really. I think that Deja Vu, which I think was a single, there's some interesting things happening in the middle of that where she goes a bit psyche, actually, which is quite, it's sort of, there's some odd, interesting little bits of production in there, but otherwise it's just not very imaginative. I don't think there's an awful lot going on to hold my interest. It's not my bag.
Is this your wheelhouse at all then? So when, you know, when En Vogue were absolutely at their zenith, or when Destiny's Child were fully on form, or when Mystique had like their three good singles, would this have spoken to you?
Not really. I sort of liked all those hits by those bands. You know, Destiny's Child I like, but I mean, they're never bands I would have bought albums by or really listened to. But this is further out than that. This isn't even sort of in my peripheral Beigeland vision, unfortunately. This is not, I don't know, there's just nothing.
It's not your cup of tea, is the technical term.
I can't, it's not my cup of tea.
What did you think, Peter? Well, are you dancing around your satchel to this?
What I think firstly is that I need to have a chat with Andrew about his tally of good Mystique singles, but we can discuss that later. Reach For Me
Yes.
is the good song on this album.
Mm-hmm. Why is that then?
It's
an hour-long podcast, there, Peter. We've got to spin it out.
Yes, well, it seems like the album itself goes on for a lot longer than an hour, and Reach For Me is the good song mm-hmm. on it, I think. I think there's a song called Life on it, where they talk about leaving the foundation strong for the next generation. I wonder if in this extension of their career, they have actually taken out a supporting wall. It's just not good. Right. It was the album was started off the idea of it being an EDM album. There's a couple of tracks on it where you can hear that has the residue of that is still there. There's a lot more electronics on it. Dawn isn't in the band anymore. It will help them, I guess, maybe charge a little bit more for the endless tours that they go on and the PAs that they perform. Yeah. But beyond that, I don't see much purpose to it, really.
I thought there was about sort of four or five good songs on there that reminded me of Sugar Babes. In that, like, importing, as you say, the grit of electronics and a little bit of sass in there that made you excited. And what you were just talking about there made me realise that probably at this stage in any artist's life, they should probably be trying to do their Confessions on the dance floor. They should probably be trying to do an album of bangers. And to me, there's an awful lot of... There's too many slowies, there's too many ballady things. Mm. And the kind of core lyrical content, much as we hate to say content, about self-empowerment and believing in yourself and moving
on.
There's
a lot of that. Yeah.
It's so generic, but yet that is... I've always thought that that's kind of, you know, why worry about the lyrics on big heartfelt R&B albums? They're there as a kind of an armature for the singing. And there's not enough epic singing on this to take your mind off how crap the lyrics are.
I was disappointed with the vocal production on it, actually, quite a lot, because obviously you think of the band, you think of great harmonies, don't you?
Yeah.
And those weren't as well done as I thought. I don't know if that's because Dawn isn't there or whatever. Mm. But
it's a 3-part, 4-part harmony.
Mm. I don't mind the sort of self-empowering lyrics. I think like if you're this lot or if you're TLC who came back last year, they kind of wrote the book on sort of modern girl band doing the empowering lyrics thing, which wasn't really around so much before that. So I don't mind them doing it. And there was a good self-empowerment song on the TLC album. I think the TLC album was actually a lot better as a sort of modern comeback album for an early 90s girl band.
How is the R&B woman group economy now? Are there any more following in their wake?
Are there? Well,
Who's the new
Fifth,
on Vogue?
Well, Fifth Harmony have just gone on hiatus.
All right, yeah.
So I think we all know what that means.
I've been thinking about going on hiatus myself, actually.
I think given that ABBA themselves are currently on hiatus, that's what we need to know about the term hiatus in pop, I think. So Fifth Harmony have gone off. Little Mix... I mean, they're not the R&B side of it, but Little Mix seem to be quite an advanced stage in their career in terms of albums at the point when a girl band would usually be going on hiatus or exploring solo projects and things. They seem to be actually heading towards some sort of career peak at the moment. It seems to be kind of going full steam ahead with them. Do they sell a lot of records? Quite a few for an act with a young audience in the streaming age. They sell quite a few, and they do well on tour as well. For instance, the Sugar Babes, one of their albums was triple platinum, sold a million copies in the end, but they couldn't go on an arena tour. They just, for whatever reason, probably because they kept changing members, but for whatever reason, they couldn't, their audience wasn't the right sort of audience to then explode into an arena-sized sort of tour, whereas Little Mix can do arena tours stadium shows.
So it's a music economy thing as much as it is a creative thing. The music economy won't let you get further than a particular point if you're this kind of a band.
Well, it's interesting because obviously Sugar Babes were around at the same time as Girls Aloud, and Girls Aloud could go on arena tours, but maybe Sugar Babes' audience was a bit too fragmented. A lot of their audience was a little bit older, maybe, who didn't want to go to what they might have perceived as being a teen audience kind of concert. I don't know what it was about them, but I mean, because obviously Sugar Babes had massive hit singles and they had massive hit albums, but for whatever reason that didn't convert to arena shows. But obviously that is where the money is, especially it wasn't so much 10 or 15 years ago, but it is now because audiences are streaming music and albums, and you don't get so much as a very expensive to run type of band. Don't get so much from that, so it has to be the arena tour and the merch that comes with it. That's where the money comes in.
Do you think people are going to want to launch bands like this in the years to come, or will it be a case of, well, you know, economy says solo artist, sad ukulele cover of
John Lewis ad, and there you go.
I mean, have we got room for the Destiny's Childs of the future?
I think there is, but I think you would need to be smart about it. And I think since the last big girl band launched
you know, whether that's Fifth Harmony or Little Mix, quite recent launches in terms of the scope of pop history, but stuff has changed so much in terms of who the gatekeepers are and, you know, where you get your music and how you find out about music. You know, the answer to all those three things is Spotify now.
Yeah.
So I think you need to be quite smart about it. And because it's music-led on Spotify, obviously New Music Friday comes up and it's just a list of songs, really. Yeah. Rather than photos or videos being the first thing you see, I think you need to make sure that the music is stronger than ever. I don't think there's any pulling the wool over anyone's eyes anymore.
I find that really dispiriting. It's like, here's your new spreadsheet on a Friday. You know, here's your new things to take off and have a listen to. And you've got no idea what's behind it, the context or the art or the artifice that makes it what it is.
Which is kind of, on one level, it's great because it levels the playing field for everybody.
On one level, it's like listening to the radio, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, back to this record. I mean, yes. I would have been much happier if it had been if it all sounded like that track we just played. If it all sounded electronic.
Just, as Dan says, it's very, very smooth. My problem is that there's three Oprah Winfreys singing about empowerment. And as I think Oprah Winfrey is wonderful, but she doesn't make records for a reason. It's just so polished and perfect, and we are so happy with ourselves and our curves. Well, no, can we have a song about you not being happy with yourself and your curves? It'd be far more interesting to get to that point. So as you say, it's this sort of strange, very long record that's a bit like something you'd hear in the background at some point. And you say what the hit was, but Reach Out for whatever. I can't tell you where that was on the album. I can't. They all sort of merge into a big En Vogue-y song that went on for hours.
Do you know what's great? If you leave it playing on Spotify, you end up into the introduction track for their 2004 Christmas album, which is a spoken word introduction going, "Hi, we're on Vogue over tinkly Christmas thing," which is quite a nice way to sort of end the album. I thought, hang on, what's this? But it was the next album. But that picked things up for me. That was my favourite track on the album.
Yeah, in April.
Mm. Well, that would be great if everyone had an album and ended with a Christmas track. Oh, I'd love that. Well, our ongoing
campaign to nationalise pop.
Yes, it's again. It's that one. Yeah.
One of the things. Okay, so yeah, we weren't very bowled over about that, were we?
No, and it's a shame because My Lovin's a really, really good record.
It is.
They were great in the 90s, and I met them, and they were so nice. Really nice ladies as well, but they've made a record that we don't like. Don't
know. Well, anyway, never
mind.
As
if we matter.
As if we matter, yes.
Anyway, finally, pop is made, as we're talking about, of great bits. It's not always all of the song. Those bits are not always appreciated. So we thought we'd get our guest to knuckle down and decide on the greatest 10 seconds in pop. What is that moment that truly takes your head off and why? Peter Robinson, we're going to start with you and your 10-second bit. I just came to say goodbye. I'm in the corner watching you kiss her. Okay, what is that and why is it so amazing, Peter?
Dancing on My Own by Robin. That's the bit that comes out of the breakdown in the middle eight. I think, well, there's a few reasons I like this. There's a million reasons I like this. It's a great song all the way through. Those 10 seconds are great because throughout pop, people have tried to figure out what the sound of heartbreak sounds like. And Robin has done it there. She sees her crush, the person she's in love with. She's gone to the club to meet them. They're with somebody else. Tears in the Toilet is a great pop genre, but she doesn't even make it to the toilet. She's crying on the dance floor. She's in the corner. She wants to go and say goodbye to them. Maybe they would get talking, and she goes to say goodbye, and she is kissing somebody else, or he is kissing somebody else. And the sound of Robin's heartbreaking is the sound of being hit around the head by a load of electronic drums.
Okay.
It's beautiful.
It is beautiful. It's the how soon is now of pop as a clock hands in the rainbow, isn't it, really? I think this in particular is the great song of the past, what, is it 15 years now? I thought it was 10 years. But it is just absolutely the most incredible song. Now routinely being murdered by buskers in a low key. I saw one outside Marks and Spencer's on Oxford Street the other day, whimpering his way through Dancing on My Own, missing the point of the song by miles. And I wanted to beat him to death with his own guitar. Danny, are you an aficionado of this song?
I know it. I can't, but again, it's not really in the middle of my wheelhouse. It's more clinging onto one of the spokes right at the end. But it is a modern pop classic, certainly.
Yeah. When did and why did Amazing Banger version of Ballad get replaced by tedious bedwetting version of Amazing Banger? Why did this happen? When did this happen? Peter Robinson, Minister of Pop.
Well, one thing I will say is that obviously, because people say, oh, you can tell a good song because it can be done in any genre.
No.
But just, no, no. There's no need to, you don't have to prove it. You can just make the statement, you can do a good song in any genre. You don't have to have...
Unplugged.
You don't have to have somebody proving that with an acoustic guitar. It makes me quite sad.
I hate the idea that the acoustic guitar version is the only legitimate way of proving something's a good song.
Has to be stripped down and naked to be honest and authentic, which
because
is
then it's
nonsense.
Real and it's made of wood and it's kind of you know, and you can hear the squeaks on the strings.
It's actually a really good song.
Yeah, and then the implication being that
when
you do it like that, then it's not really a good song because there's electronic trickery. Electronic trickery.
It's pop music, you know, and John Humphreys always pronounces it pop music. He can't pronounce pop music properly. It's pop
as if he's being forced to talk about Tamagotchis or something.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Mind you, I did hear the other day popping up at random on the iTunes a Winston Reedy's roots reggae version of Wichita Lineman. That certainly proves that a good song can be done in any style because this is not the greatest production ever, but it was pretty kind of, you know, pretty persuasive. I am a lineman, jink 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 for the county, jink jink. that was pretty good.
I thought you were going to say that John Humphreys had popped up on your iTunes.
What, doing a reggae version of Wichita Lineman?
It took me a while to get that. Okay.
John Humphreys in dub, yes.
Yeah. Dan Mayer, it's your turn. Let's listen first and then you can say what it is.
So that basically that's the same bit of Robin, isn't it?
We've both gone for the drums today.
Absolutely.
The drums are
very early
in
example
later.
Of coming back in after the break. Yes. Yeah. But in a slightly different way.
So what is that?
That is the Bobby Fuller Four and I Fought the Law. And of course the Law won.
As is so often the case.
It's just one of those little moments where someone's had an idea that that is so satisfying and thrilling. It's not, I mean, it wasn't their idea, because if you listen to the original Crickets version, I think it was originally Crickets' song, and actually pretty much every version of this song respects that idea, that behind this line, robbing people with a six gun, or annoyingly, in the original Crickets one, it's robbing people with a zip gun, which slightly destroys the idea.
Yeah. Well, anyway, science fiction space bank robbery.
Bit irritating. So I looked at a zip gun, this is an aside, a zip gun is any sort of homemade gun. I didn't realise this, but a zip gun is sort of something that you've basically put together at home. So it could include, as a subgenre, the six gun, so that's sort of fine. But the idea that what we're hearing is the six bullets of the six gun, it just seems such a brilliant idea that, you know, I want to shake the hand of whoever thought of that. It's just such a nice little... beautiful, thrilling moment.
There is a music theory term for this, which I don't know what it is, but it's something like onomatopoeia, where there's an element in the music, you know, like when, you know, somebody will mention a car crash, you'll hear breaking glass in the background, or you'll hear some kind of musical attempt to approximate the screech of tyres on a guitar or whatever.
Yes.
Listeners, text us in, tweet us with what it is, because we don't know what it is. Better or worse than the Clash's version?
I quite like the Clash's version, but the Bobby Fuller 4-1 for me is... kind of is my favourite version, but I just think that little—it's just one of these little satisfying things that's just
and never sounds crap as well. Never wears out. Never gets boring. Never, I've heard this bit before.
No, it's that he was looking forward to that bit coming. I know.
When did you discover this song? Can you remember when it came into your
universe? Well, I think I'd always known the Clash one, and then when I started getting into my 60s gear and the garage and psych and all that sort of stuff, I think it popped up on one of those compilations. And I thought, I didn't realise it was an old song.
Is this one of the staples of your freaky psych set?
Not quite sort of psyche enough to be a staple of my psych set, but it's you know, it's in there.
Okay, Andrew Harrison, what is your greatest 10 seconds in pop? Well, play it now.
Have a listen to this. I am a massive cliche. It's the Pet Shop Boys. It is the string exploding orchestra ascending into the stratosphere bit in Left to My Own Devices, which for my money is their best song. It's got everything I like in it, which is Trevor Horn and a house bass line, and it's a banger. To me, this is the kind of Beatles Day in the Life moment of rave, where we are teleported, exploded out into a wider universe by the old strings soaring up touch, which actually is also an in-joke as well, because Neil and Chris are obviously pop scholars of the finest accord and they know what they're doing. So it's like, that is clearly a bit of a Sgt. Pepper's moment. The whole song is their Sgt. Pepper's song. It's inside Neil's head. It's the world of him growing up from Che Guevara and Debussy to a disco beat and a little kid playing in the back garden up to the strangely boring world of the pop star now, where you spend a lot of time hanging around in your house thinking about shopping and reading magazines. And then it just kind of takes that world of mundanity and takes it off into the outside universe. The great thing also as well about the 8-minute version is at the end, all of those subjects are chopped up and rearranged in a William Burroughs style. Right. In this kind of dream sequence, what is it? Che Guevara's drinking tea. Mm. All these things. And it's just the most, most brilliant thing. But that bit in particular, that 10 seconds, I never, ever, ever get bored of it. Peter, you really hate the Pet Shop Boys, don't you? They really
terrible.
Yeah.
Much, much prefer Erasure. I'm joking, of course.
Yes, listeners.
Obviously, that's a great moment. But if we're going into the best 10 seconds on introspective, surely...
listeners, yes.
Surely the bit on Always On My Mind in My House where it goes from the boring bit and smashes into the proper number one version of Always On My Mind, that is quite good, right?
You call it the boring bit. I call it the actual proper house music bit. When it's when it's like the bass, it's all the bass line. It's the bass line from You're Gonna Miss Me When I'm Gone. It's do-do-do-do-do-do. It's, you know, remember that? You're going to miss me, Yeah. With a phone call in the middle, with the Spanish woman going on a, you know, great record. But you're right. When it turns into the number one hit single version, that too isn't also a proper head exploder.
But this whoosh is in the Communards, Don't Leave Me This Way. They go, whoa. And you hear it underneath. It's in Confidence, man. They're going, whoa, underneath. And what are we all saying, though? You're not saying the obvious thing, that rush. It's a rush, isn't it? What they're doing is replicating being on the dance floor, drug rush. And I think that it does make my, prickle all up. You know.
She's miming prickly arms.
Prickly
hairs,
arms, whatever they're called.
It's all about release, isn't it? All these moments are about anticipation thing. And release, aren't they? And if I think of, I've slightly outstepped by choosing an ancient rock and roll song, but I mean, I could have easily, I thought it was a difficult one to pick.
But
I thought also about Sparks' number one song in Heaven, which I absolutely love. The long version of that, which has this massive long choral bit for about 5 minutes at the beginning, and then the beat comes in, and it's one of the longest bits of anticipation and release in pop, which is brilliant. I could have equally chosen that.
But that's also the key change, and we haven't had a key change yet.
We haven't had a key change.
Key change is the big.
Later,
is the big
on another programme, in fact, you're invited back for another show to do greatest key changes in pop.
Ooh.
And can we find anything? Because obviously that's a real obvious staple when you go up a key, but we need to find an example of somebody coming down a key for effect.
Oh, there are.
Your homework. Yeah. Okay, we'll do that on another show. But Dan, I don't think you're out of theme at all, really, because rowdy, idiot rock and roll songs about robbing and driving around in cars with girls, that was the rave of its day. That was the disgusting, bad influence music of its time. So these are all of a piece. I think they all fit in together.
And what I like about all of these, you and I both chose drums, didn't we? Yeah. And you've got the whoosh. These are things that wouldn't appear on the sheet music for a song. These are things that were done during the recording or in the studio, and they've gone, right, how can we make this better? And it's people just throwing in a trick and making a song that is already amazing, really amazing.
Yeah. Well, it's funny you should say that because Sian, we've got your choice now. Sean, that was your choice.
That's my, bit minimal.
What's this mysterious little-known piece of music you've unearthed?
Is there anyone in the country who doesn't know what that is the intro to? And is there anyone where you just don't start singing it along while it starts? Yeah, it's Blue Monday intro by New Order. And I hear that, and again, it's the endorphin thing. I hear that, and it's just a drum beat. It's a program drum. And I immediately am in a different state of mind. I'm immediately in a massively brilliant mood. I want to listen to the whole song. It also, I want to say, though, there's a bit... You know how we're saying that these are the most fantastic bits? There's a bit in Blue Monday that is the worst bit in a song ever as well.
Which is that bit?
This is the bit. There are three chords in the middle of it. It's probably after, about two-thirds of the way through. It goes ding, ding, ding.
Yeah.
For no reason, never comes back in. It's really crap. It's really indie schmin. And obviously, someone was begging to put that in. They only got three chords in the end. They didn't get the whole of the rest of the end of the song. That's the worst bit, and that always makes me wince. But the beginning of Blue Monday, as I say, I can't.
So you're saying it's not a perfect record?
It's not a perfect record. No, it's got the three chords in it. Those three chords.
Because there shouldn't be perfect things.
Yes,
there should
it
be things.
Matter.
No, it's like the imperfection in the rug, isn't it?
Absolutely. It makes six better. And actually, for my imperfection on Blue Monday is the syndrums bit in the middle, which just goes boom, 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 completely out of sync with anything. Just because they seem to have got to a bit in the song or the arrangement. It's not a song. They've got into the bit of the program. It's like, we need something to happen here. We're not entirely sure what it is. So Hookie's going to bash some syndromes for no particularly good reason. And then we'll get on with the next bit.
Yeah.
But this is,
the chords.
This fits in with what Dan was saying about anticipation, because this is a great, great moment of anticipation, isn't it? But also, they wrote it to try and work out how their drum machine worked.
Yeah.
So that's Peter's point about...
Yeah, that's perfect. It's the mistake, isn't it? It's that synchronicity of a mistake, and then suddenly this is what you create. And it is incredible. And you listen to that record, like you're saying, the Bangles sound 80s. That is timeless to me. I don't think that has aged at all, that record. Mm. You can play it and it will fill the floor when you play that at the disco.
Do you remember, and we probably all do because we're all old, in the 80s there was a moment when literally everything nicked that drum beat. So every Hazel Dean and Divine record and every kind of pop record and everything had a bit in the middle.
Yeah.
It was great, wasn't it?
Dead or Alive. It was amazing time.
It was an amazing time.
It was a great time to be alive. Yeah.
Why don't drums sound like that anymore? Because they were incredibly harsh drums, and the drums now are very kind of round and boofy, aren't they? And this is really, really harsh and blat, 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 blat. Why is that?
Maybe it's authentic. This hunt for... authenticity that doesn't really exist.
Mm. It sounds like Manchester. Sorry,
Artifice was, people were happy with Artifice maybe in the 80s. And
there's also people trying to make things better, isn't it? Because someone at a keyboard manufacturer will have gone, oh, that sounds a bit harsh. Let's see if we can make it sound more like a real
sound like a drum.
More like a real drum.
But the reason it sounds amazing is because it doesn't sound like a real drum.
Exactly. People have tried to fix things and they've actually broken them.
They've made things worse by making them better. Well, I mean, that's kind of, again, back to my monomaniacal obsession with Acid House. The reason Acid House sounds amazing is it was a machine that was supposed to play the bass line if you were a, country singer or a wedding singer. The 303 bass line, it was supposed to just play little kind of walking blues bass lines, but the sounds didn't sound like a proper bass, and there were these weird knobs where you could change the sound while it was playing. Then people started buggering around with it. Next thing, Acid House. The abuse of technology. This is what it's all about.
Why do you think they put those knobs in? Because they would go to extremes that no one in that sort of, in the intended situation would ever use it for. So do you think it was somebody at the design stage going, this sounds quite good, maybe somebody will use it for more
I
than
think
just karaoke?
So. I once tried to get someone from Yamaha to speak about, the people who actually create the sounds in 303s and 404s and stuff like that. Never got that far, actually, because they're a bit far away in Japan. Yeah. But there are people who do make those sounds. They do want you to modulate and do all those things that are really, really exciting. And they must have thought, well, you can do that on the hoof and modulate
that,
while
that was just the time just before sampling and sound production technology got to the point of verisimilitude, where like you can just put in a box the actual sound of a jazz bass or the actual sound of a Rhodes piano, and they had to sort of approximate it, and probably clearly didn't know what they were doing, because I've read loads of things where their engineers saying, oh, this was a terrible, awful device that we made, the 303 or the 808, it didn't sound right, and we were very glad to be able to supersede it and put something good out. The good thing they put out nobody remembers and nobody wants, and these things are now replicated in software boxes. People will pay a load of money for a second-hand one. You're listening to the Music Technology Podcast of Sound on
and
Sound.
We will
magazine.
Bore you about sounds.
Yes. Well, those, I think we could all agree, were all genuinely amazing bits of pop music, and we'll probably do that again at some time in another podcast in the future. But we are coming to the end of the show, and that means closing time chatter, where our guests will tell us what they're going to be discussing this weekend over a glass of Arctic Seagull wine. Yes, the Inuit really do stuff a dead seagull into a bottle of water and let it brew to make wine. I discovered that while I was looking up Strange Drinks. Peter Robinson, what's your closing time chatter for the week?
It's youth hosteling with Chris Eubank. Well, it's actually Mariah Carey staying in a hostel. Supposedly. So I get press releases at all hours of the day, and they usually make me want to cry for one reason or another, but this one was particularly bad. It's a youth hostel company whose name I won't mention because obviously they haven't contributed to the running costs of this excellent podcast.
Why
should I? Yeah. Photograph of Mariah in some sort of hostel next to a man in his pants.
Where is this?
This is in Barcelona.
Okay.
Apparently, headline is Diva Mariah Carey stays in hostel on trip to Barcelona. She stayed in a hostel on a recent trip. She was in the city starring in a short travel film about hostels. Can you see how this could have all come together?
Absolutely.
Right. So my interest in this is kind of... Because someone asked on Twitter, how much do you think she got paid? And I think she's in that position where... she probably got paid somewhere in this sweet spot, which is more than you think that company would be able to afford, but far less than you think Mariah Carey would be able to charge. She has this sort of status now of like Snoop Dogg appearing in Money Supermarket
probably.
Ad he was in, where you kind of think, this is a massive global star, this is an amazing get, but actually it was only 50 grand or something like that. So I'm sort of interested in her now being in that position, but also she... sort of gets that she's in that position and plays up to it, and she kind of does her own memes and things on social media. So she sort of knows that she's in this slight position of uselessness now, but
is still amazing and is all the more amazing because she knows exactly what her status is in the world.
So this is the contemporary celebrity stands in the middle of a promotional opportunity, shrugging and pulling her face. What am I doing here, readers? I have no idea.
As we used to call it, she's in reception.
Yes.
She's waiting downstairs. She'll be seen soon.
Do they at any point use the headline or the slogan, keep calm and carry on?
No, they do not.
Thank God for that. Dan Mayer, what's your closing time chatter? I believe you've been doing fall DJing marathons.
Fall DJing marathon, yes. A couple of weeks ago, I thought it be a nice little thing to do, a little tribute to Marquee Smith, that I would do a little DJ set somewhere playing fall things. And I ended up in a bar in Brighton doing a 7.5 hour straight, which was quite a weird and enjoyable and spiritual experience. So I was playing fall, and a few years ago I put together a compilation for Ace called Before the Fall, which is originals of songs that the fall had covered. So I put a few of those in. I put a few things in that the fall had ripped off, which just varied it a little bit. Quite weird things like Higher Ground by Stevie Wonder, for instance, which you wouldn't have expected the fall to rip off.
What did they rip off for that?
There's a B-side called Zagreb, where they've basically taken that synth thing. Spinal Tap, Tonight I'm Going to Rock You Tonight, which they ripped off Athlete Cured on the Friends Experiment. There's a few others. So actually, there was a bit of variety. It wasn't just wall-to-wall drunk man shouting. Yeah, there was a bit of variety. But it's quite a sort of transcendent experience. Have you been DJing for 7.5 hours?
We could have carried on. We booked for 7.5 hours.
Well, I said I was going to do it. It was sort of like Sunday afternoon thing. So I started sort of about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. The idea was I was going to go on to about 9. But then at 9 o'clock, the bar manager said, we can carry on if you want. All right, let's see how far I can push this. Yeah. And sort of did another hour and a half. And then there was a handful of people there who were sort of going, carry on. I thought, I can't think of it. I need something to end the set with. So I was going to start. I was going to end with a track called Immortality, which seems appropriate enough. But then I played that, and they said, carry on. So then I had to think, right, I need to shape this. I need an encore. And I finished with Clear Off, which seemed also
very right. Yes.
And I thought, well, I can't carry on. I can't think of another one to top that. So I'm actually going to stop now. But I thoroughly enjoyed the experience. I quite like the idea of now attempting a sort of 10 or 12 hour DJ marathon. If anyone would like to have me.
So this is the sort of the shoot horses, don't they, of fall day DJ, you sort of sweating into your record
to
box.
To see how it kind of reprograms your brain slightly after sort of.
Did you get any requests?
Yeah, I did get a few requests. Yeah. Annoyingly, some I hadn't brought with me. Which you think, how is that possible? But yeah, no, I played. There were some satisfied customers.
What did you leave out? Moleskine Tyrol, perhaps?
Didn't play Moleskine Tyrol. Yeah,
very wise.
No.
There's a lot.
There's 32 albums or whatever. Actually, 7.5 hours. You really are cherry picking.
There's a fair few songs that are literally just dictaphone recordings, maybe arguing with the sound man, aren't there?
That kind of
as
thing.
A full track.
Quite
didn't play them.
No.
God. Well, I think you should do it again, and we will.
If anyone would like to host anywhere between 5 and 10 hours of me DJing fall and related content, I'm happy to do it.
Dan's the fall. Sean.
I went to a lovely reading yesterday of Audrey Niffenegger and Eddie Campbell. Eddie Campbell's the comic book artist. Audrey Niffenegger is a writer and artist. And they've done a book together called Bizarre Romance, which is sort of a bit about their bizarre romance because they met while they were on other sides of the globe. And they're very, very sweet. And it's a lovely book, but also it's got lots and lots of pictures in it. And I do think we need to bring back this idea. I just sometimes go to a bookshop. Aren't books boring? Aren't they boring?
Pop culture podcast about entertainment and the arts.
But
books
you know what
boring.
I mean? I mean, they're sold as boring to boring people. This is great, wonderful, fantastic. No, can we have pictures? And it's so wonderful because it's got Eddie's illustrations in it. It's got Audrey's writing. And there's a sort of magic realism about what she does and a weirdness and a strangeness. And I thought, more of this, please. So go out and buy their book, Bizarre Romance. And then can you, everybody, write books and illustrate them as well? And we make books interesting again.
Have you heard, Sean? I'm going to take you to the shop called Gosh Comics of comic books, which have got drawings and all. Eddie Campbell, of course, did the great From Hell with Alan Moore,
the fantastic
exploration of the Jack the Ripper mythos, which everybody ought to read.
He's earned his stripes,
he
Eddie Campbell.
Has.
Yeah.
Well, I presume this is available in Gosh Comics as well.
It will be available in Gosh Comics.
Oh, I might go give it a go. Well, my closing time chatter, it's very simple. I went to see an incredible band, Judah. At Lexington in London, they sound like Slade, The Sweet, The Buzzcocks and the incredible Alex Harvey Band at the same time. They look like Morrissey's band. They are an Italian glam bovo rock band with very short hair. They look like friends of the show, Alexis Petridis, and they stomp in their boots. And I actually think he's trying to look like them now. He's cultivated. He's gone bovo. They've renewed my... I dance to disco. I don't like rock very much, but they've renewed my faith in rock because they sound like my first favourite band, which was Slade. Everything's in three, four bother beat time, loads of hand clapping, loads of football chanting, and they're called Judah. And the new album is the new single is called With Admirable Simplicity Rock and Roll Music. We're going to play out with it in a minute. Thank you to our special guests, Dan May and Peter Robinson. Please do come back again.
Thank you very much.
Hope you've enjoyed the experience. Please do leave your feedback in the visitor's book. Thank you, as ever, to my irreplaceable co-pilot, Sean, and to producer, Jack Claremont. He's in the background there. Remember, you can hear all of our past episodes at audioboom.com/channel/bigmouth. And if you want to support the show, you can buy us a pint via patreon.com/bigmouthpodcast. We're back next week with our 100th show. Can you believe it? In the meantime, here's Judah with rock and roll music. Life's fashion, gonna lose my sight. Soon on I tell you, I'm gonna make you mine. You burning cooking, make a light. I'm gonna sing, I'm gonna fight. Ain't nobody gonna put it down. You're gonna be the first to hit the ground. It's not good. Music's under such a waste of